You're listening to Groundwire, grassroots news coverage from coast to coast to coast.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Hi, my name's David Karchin.
And I'm Zoe Lusky.
This week on Groundwire, we bring you an update on the Free Gaza Flotilla.
The Yukon says Kill Bill 82.
And toxic dumping in the Mi'kmaq First Nation.
But first, the headlines.
The Canadian National Boreal Forest Agreement is in danger. Canadians were told that the Boreal Forest Agreement, signed on May the 18th, was a historic coming together of the timber industry and environmentalists, and that it would protect 29 million hectares of vital habitat, about twice the size of Germany. But in fact, only a 12-page abridged version of the agreement has been made public. The full agreement was leaked to the Vancouver Media Co-op on May the 19th. The agreement deters logging in only 72,000 hectares, does not protect woodland caribou, and has excluded Indigenous peoples from the management of the boreal lands. Some First Nations representatives are concerned that the proposal solidifies corporate control over forests in Canada. The Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement was signed by Canadian forest products companies and several prominent environmental groups, such as Greenpeace, the David Suzuki Foundation, and the Ivy Foundation. Activists say it will make it more difficult to effectively campaign against large-scale resource extraction by the Canadian forest industry. That story with files from the Vancouver Media Co-op and Dawn Paley.
With a few hours' notice, communities across Canada held emergency rallies to denounce Israel's attack on the Free Gaza Flotilla that killed at least 9 people and injured many more. The 6 ships were besieged in international waters early in the morning on May 31st, carrying medical, reconstruction, and educational supplies, nearly 800 international activists and politicians. 37 members of the UN Human Rights Council voted to pursue an international fact-finding mission to Gaza. In Ottawa, demonstrators gathered on May 31st to protest the attacks and the visit by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We asked Dylan Perry, Ottawa-based organizer with Independent Jewish Voices, what led to the massive demonstration.
There is an ongoing litany of atrocities that Israel is perpetrating, but every so often it crosses a line that is actually not only wrong and unethical and immoral, but also exposes its actions for what they are.
Also in Montreal, hundreds of demonstrators rallied outside of the Israeli and Turkish consulates during rush hour.
Friends, today we're not going to hold a minute of silence. We're going to hold a minute of yelling our hearts out, because we had 62 years of silence. Yell out for a minute. Let's do it.
Recently released human rights worker Kevin Nish arrived home in Victoria on June the 5th, and told the media that 16 people were killed the night that Israeli commandos attacked the Mavri Marmara. Until now, media have reported that only 9 were killed.
16 people died. And we found out today that some of them were executed. And I saw two of the bodies. They had two shots in the side of the head, beaten clean, and that's what happened.
The Israeli Navy has distanced itself from allegations that the ship's activists provoked the IDF forces. A group of top Israeli Naval Reserve officers publicly called on Israel to allow an external probe, and in a letter to Prime Minister Netanyahu wrote, quote, "We protest the fact that responsibility for the tragic results was immediately thrust onto the organizers of the flotilla," unquote.
The Rachel Corrie 8 ship, originally delayed due to mechanical problems, headed to break the siege on Gaza, but was hijacked Saturday morning by the Israeli military. The confiscated cargo includes medical equipment and cement, as well as 20 tons of paper from the people of Norway donated to UN-run schools in Gaza. The Canadian government has not yet condemned the Israeli Defense Forces operation.
In related news, Pride Toronto bows to pressure to censor this year's parade.
Rachel Epstein, Sky Gilbert, and Al Farouk Kaki are among over 20 past honored dykes, grand marshals, and award recipients who have returned their awards from Pride Toronto in protest.
At a press conference on Tuesday, May the 25th, the organizing committee for Toronto's Pride Parade announced that it was banning the use of the words Israeli apartheid in the upcoming parades. The announcement comes as a direct attack on queers against Israeli apartheid, who have been marching in the parades for the past 3 years, but who have come under increasing criticism. The city's announcement comes just weeks after city councillor and mayoral candidate Giorgio Marmoliti presented a motion in city council to revoke city funding of the parade if Queers Against Israeli Apartheid was allowed to march in this year's parades. Pride's announcement was met by about 150 protesters from Queers Against Israeli Apartheid and the newly formed Pride Coalition for Free Speech. Jenny Pito is an organiser from Queers Against Israeli Apartheid and was at the press conference.
Especially now that Toronto's been chosen to host World Pride in 2014, right? There's a lot of pressure to tone down messaging, to tone down the politics, and to turn it into just some sort of party. And that's been something I think that Quiet has been bringing a lot of attention to, because the right wing in and out of Pride are saying, you know, Pride is not political, it's just a celebration. And this has kind of forced this issue to a head, along with some other issues, obviously. But, you know, we're actually standing up and saying Pride is political.
Stay tuned to Groundwire, where we will bring you updates during Pride on Queers Against Israeli Apartheid.
Also from Toronto, on May 25th, all charges were dropped against Michael Bryant, former Ontario Attorney General. Later that day, hundreds gathered for a memorial ride to remember Darcy Allen Shepherd, the cyclist whose violent death led to the charges of criminal negligence against Bryant. A YouTube video of the incident has been viewed over 65,000 times as the city attempts to piece together the last moments of Shepherd's life. Shepherd's blood alcohol level post-mortem was twice the legal limit, but Bryant, who fled the scene, was never administered a breathalyzer. Allegations of preferential treatment appeared early when a special VIP unit of the Toronto Police took charge of the case. Richard Peck is the Crown prosecutor who decided there was not enough evidence to charge Bryant. Peck, normally a Vancouver defense attorney, was brought in after police laid charges of criminal negligence causing death. Bryant's most recent public statement on May 26 said his Saab convertible lurched forward on its own, striking a cycling Shepherd who grabbed his car. Shepherd's family has not said if they will pursue a civil suit, and there remain many unanswered questions regarding the case. In honor of Darcy Allen Shepherd, an active member of the bicycle courier community, a white bicycle marks the spot where he died.
It's an amazing history and story which that bicycle has gone through. It's been through three construction sites, three reincarnations, and just the people refuse to let that specific memory die. We've had a lot of ghost bikes that have died because the city has taken them out, city has destroyed them, always the city has destroyed them. So, like, this one has actually stayed a very long time.
The Toronto Bike Messengers Association has set up a trust fund for Shepherd's Children at tobma.com. Canadians may yet be permitted to read a censored analysis of the mining industry. Talon Books announced it will release the controversial book, Imperial Canada, a book examining the environmental and labor practices of mining companies registered in Canada. Although originally threatened with legal action by mining giant Barrick Gold if they continued with publication this spring, Talon Books has put Imperial Canada back on their list for fall 2010 publication. Imperial Canada is based on a French title that is also before the courts in a defamation suit. The BC Civil Liberties Association has called Barrick's letter censorship. In an interview with Red Eye Radio, publisher Carl Siegler said as far as Talon Books was concerned, Barrick Gold had no right to demand or to see copies of manuscripts that were in development prior to their public release. He also expressed frustration with the Canadian legal system, saying it is far too easy for corporations to charge defamation and thereby shut down critical discourse.
I was astonished to be in this, to realize that I was living in a country in which such a thing was possible, and that the lawyers for Barrick Gold would take it for granted that it was their right to demand to see a manuscript like this in progress. I was floored.
But the threats extended to translators, and so lawyers advised that Barrack's wealth could tie up publication indefinitely, risking Talon's other titles. Readers will have to wait until the spring for the full manuscript, but Talon promises Imperial Canada will boldly ask why Canada is so attractive to over 70% of the world's mining companies.
You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News. We're broadcast across the country and can be heard online at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Voices of Our Nations, an 8-hour broadcast on Thursday, June 17th from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. in celebration of Aboriginal peoples from coast to coast to coast. The broadcast will be live from Montreal's Native Friendship Centre in collaboration with CKUT Radio and producers across the country. Voices of Our Nations features voices from the Oka Crisis, a history of Indigenous organizing in Canada, musicians, artists, stone carving, and more. For more information, check out www.ckut.ca.
Sounds of color covered by clouds of thunder hovering down as a humming. The rich boys are always so paranoid. Does she like me for me or my money? I guess I can't afford. They wanna ride in my car, they wanna turn it up loud. Still I don't feel like I stand out in a crowd. Slackers are stealing drinks off of tables. They're wiping glasses with their sleeves as if they were able to wipe all the stains from the sheets of the beds of all the women they wish they never met. But they did, and it's too late to turn it around. Go out with some style, don't lose any more.
This is Groundwire Community Radio News. The music you just heard was by Edmonton band The City Streets. And now for our feature stories. Pictou Landing First Nation Mi'kmaq are taking action after too many broken promises by the Nova Scotia and federal governments. The pulp and paper mill beside the reserve has been dumping toxic effluent into Boat Harbour for 47 years. Sickness rates are high in the First Nation, and the governments and the mill's operators are refusing to take responsibility. The community is planning to relocate in September if there is no follow-up from officials. From CKDU Radio in Halifax, Gianna Lauren reports.
On Victoria Day, the Pictou Landing community, located on Boat Harbour in Mi'kmaq territory, held a water walk at Point Pleasant Park in Halifax, declaring the community's decision to abandon their current environment. The effluent catastrophe from a looming pulp and paper mill has intoxicated the land, the air, and its surrounding waters, not to mention the health of each and every one of the 700 members of the Pictou Landing Band. The Water Walk, an annual event honoring the sacred value of water, tied in a press conference to announce that the community will be relocating to none other than Point Pleasant Park itself.
We've come to a point now where the government has basically said there is going to be another generation of effluent dump into that facility. They've given them $70 million. That leaves the community with absolutely no choice than to leave that area. Every other piece of property in Nova Scotia is spoken for, and everybody has claimed some part of our territory, except for Point Pleasant Park.
Kevin, a member of the Pictou Landing Band and co-coordinator of the Water Walk, explains that the community plans to take legal action and move from Pictou Landing to Point Pleasant Park unless authorities cooperate by addressing the environmental destruction of the area and the community's failing health conditions.
The company has not disclosed whatever they're doing up there, but it seems as though the rule of law doesn't apply in our traditional territory. The band has made thousands of requests over the years. For 47 years now, they've been asking what they're doing to them. They've asked for health tests, they've asked for environmental assessments, they've asked for environmental testing. And the government has managed to bob and weave through regulations and irresponsibility to declare that politics is far more important than the lives of those poor people.
Roger Hunka, director of the Maritime Aboriginal People's Council, speaks about the history of Boat Harbour and its importance to the Pictou Landing community.
It was known as a landing spot way back in the 16th century, a very beautiful spot because of its shelter there were, and that's why it was called Boat Harbour. It was a harbour for boats, but most of the beautiful spots that Aboriginal people used in Mi'kmaq were coves like this. You know, there's fresh water running, a closed spot that's sheltered from the back winds, something to have a community with, right. You know. And close by the water and everything else, food and stuff like that. So that pulp and paper mill looked for an area and said, well, let's put it way down there. And that's what they said. There's only Indians there. You could see that was their thinking. They ain't going to say much. And then Robin says, well, you know, it's okay. It's not really toxic. We've proven it by our so-called science, and so don't worry about it. If there is any problem, we'll help you out. It's a story of total abuse. So then you have a settlement that happened. Key issue is this. You're doing a process that in today's age is terrible. It's like you're diluting milk with poison, and you know it's wrong. And, you know, they'll say, well, it's for employment. What's the value of a job versus the value of a life? But this Boat Harbour situation is really an atrocity. it repeats itself all over. And not just here in Nova Scotia, where in Canada we have over 73 nations of Aboriginal people. Many live on their traditional ancestral homelands. But creating economic opportunity for others has been at the cost of not just Aboriginal people, but poor people.
You don't know what it's like to have fresh air, uncontaminated soil, trees that you can go under. You have no idea how beautiful normal is, you know, when you come from hell.
Some days you have, like, blisters just from walking on the beach. And, you know, it's got to be cleaned up. And we've been fighting with the government for so long, and they're not honoring our agreements. So the community got together, and we're starting our own fight because they don't want to listen to our leaders. It's our children we're worried about, our next generation.
For Groundwire, this is Gianna Lauren reporting from CKDU in Halifax.
In April 2010, development ministers from the G8 countries met in Halifax to discuss maternal and child health and international aid in preparation for the G8 G20 summits in Ontario in just a few short weeks. Meanwhile, a broad coalition of citizens, labor, social, environmental, indigenous, and feminist activists peacefully protested against what they consider to be the profit-driven politics represented by the G8 leaders.
Development ministers from the G8 countries met in Halifax in preparation for the G8 and G20 summits in Ontario this June. Canadian Minister of International Cooperation Beth Oda summarizes Canada's agenda at a press conference.
In January, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced that Canada would be making healthy mothers, healthy children, and reducing their mortality the top development priority at the June G8 Leader Summit. Family planning is a way of spacing your children to have control over your family and does not include abortion.
To show their disagreement with this position, members of the Feminist League for Agitation Propaganda, FLAP, staged a demonstration outside Halifax City Hall. FLAP member Rosie Oilfoot comments.
In response to Bev Oda telling everyone that Canada was deciding not to include funding for abortion, even though a lot of the other G8 countries have decided that abortion is crucial to family planning. So FLAP went down to Grand Parade and we died. We mourned, we cried, we went down and we staged a die-in in Grand Parade. We're trying to get across just how many women, 20 million women worldwide, risk their lives with illegal, unsafe abortions because there is no funding, there is no access, or it's just too difficult, or it's illegal. As a result of that, 70,000 women die a year. Those numbers are disgusting. These deaths are preventable, and the fact that Canada is not willing to take a stand and contribute to that is, in my opinion, repulsive.
On Sunday, before the development ministers' meeting, over 300 people marched through the streets of Halifax to rally against the G8 and its agenda. Another protest took place on Monday morning in front of Pier 21, where the development ministers met. Although the protests were peaceful, a union leader was arrested at Monday's picket. Witnesses Tony Tracy and Jake Feldman described the circumstances of the arrest.
One of our comrades was dragged from the rally by three policemen, thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and taken away. Tony, who was that?
That was Sister Toni McAfee. Toni is a longtime leading trade unionist. She's the education coordinator for CUPW, the Postal Workers Union, throughout the Atlantic region, well known by community activists and labor activists, both in the Atlantic region and nationally. I would argue that the arrest this morning was unprovoked, that it was an attempt to undermine the leadership of the rally and the demo, and certainly Toni is an elected union official, not somebody who, you know, was carrying a weapon or anything of that sort.
I was just right in front of her. The cops were sort of pushing people onto the sidewalk, and as she was walking forward, the cop pushed her because I guess she wasn't moving fast enough for them. And then she turned around and said something to the effect of, like, get your hands off of me or don't touch me. One cop put his arm around her neck, headlocked her, chokeheld her. She was holding a coffee at the time. When the cop pulled her around, her coffee flung, got on one of the cops' uniforms. Three cops pulled her down and arrested her.
The G8 Development Ministers' meeting in Halifax concluded with the unprovoked arrest of union leader Toni McAfee, peaceful and spirited protests, but without clear commitments from the G8 on how to improve the health of mothers and children worldwide.
We did not talk about dollars that will be put forward. We understand it's a responsibility for our taxpayers to ensure that we are getting the biggest bang for the buck.
Looking forward to the G8 and G20 summits later in June, Brian O'Neill from Oxfam Maritime says,
"Where the streets now will be in the streets in Ontario in June when the G8 and G20 meet. We are going to have our ideas, we're going to have our suggestions, we're going to push, push, push."
For Groundwire, this is Felix Kahneman from CKDU in Halifax.
Stay tuned to Groundwire for G8 and G20 news on the ground. Our next two editions will be produced from the G20 Alternative Media Centre.
In the Yukon, a proposed bill threatens to confiscate property from citizens under a civil forfeiture act. Other provinces with similar legislation have made provisions for law enforcement to seize and retain property even when no charges are laid. In BC, within 17 months, the government has made more than $2 million. With Bill 82's proposal, Yukon residents are asking, where will the money end up? From CJSF Burnaby, Samantha Daniels has this report.
"Innocent until proven guilty" is a phrase that may be losing some validity in the Yukon with the new proposed legislation from the Yukon Party. A board member of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, Megan Vist-Dunbar, breaks down BC's Civil Forfeiture Act, which is very similar to the new proposed legislation in the Yukon.
"All that has to be done is an allegation of criminal conduct, and then that only has to be proved on the balance of probabilities, which is very different from the existing provisions for forfeiture, which are in the Criminal Code and the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. The provisions in those acts are only triggered by an actual criminal conviction based on the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The legislation that we have in BC and that's being proposed in the Yukon defines unlawful activity as any offense under any Act of Canada or the Yukon, and does not require conviction, just an allegation of criminal conduct and on a different standard of proof."
The profits from the sale of items which were seized under the Civil Forfeiture Act in BC were supposed to go to the police and those in the community affected by the illegal activity, yet some people aren't sure all of the money is going to the right place.
In the 2 years that the legislation had been in place, $4.5 million worth of property had been forfeited. And only $1.1 million of that was paid out in compensation, prevention, and remediation. So we don't know where the other $3.4 million went. The legislation in the Yukon has even less provisions about where the money would go. And we have to really consider if this money is going into policing services and what kind of potential for conflict of interest that raises if police are investigating unlawful activities and ultimately might benefit monetarily from that.
British Columbia has its own Civil Forfeiture Act, and although the act is meant to punish criminal activity and those profiting from illegal acts, civilians with no involvement whatsoever in illegal activities, such as landlords or business partners, are being affected, as Nicole Sagan, the National Director of End Prohibition, explains how the NDP party in the Yukon is not happy about the proposed new bill.
"The Yukon NDP specifically opposed Bill 82 precisely because there was no basis for appeal. So basically, you could be completely innocent of any wrongdoing, have your property seized, and you would have no recourse in order to claim it. So you'd have to deal with your either on the brink of poverty now or having to just deal with finding shelter. So really, this legislation is quite problematic and can really drastically increase the problems that we have with affordable housing and just basic security of the person and knowing that your bills are going to be paid and that your home won't be seized."
Citizens that have had property seized in BC were able to appeal the decision, although that course of action did not end in the way the original property owner had hoped.
"The BC Civil Liberties Association has gone through with an appeal of the BC Civil Forfeiture Act, and unfortunately they lost. So I think it really does come down to more the voting public in telling their representatives that this legislation is wrong. It punishes the wrong people. It can be used indiscriminately and disproportionately against minorities, low-income groups. There's basically no protection for innocent parties in this legislation."
And with no protection over innocent parties, Yukon Bill 82, the Civil Forfeiture Act, if passed, could put some members of the community through a lot of unjustified stress. Samantha Daniels at CJSF for Groundwire Community Campus Radio.
on the ground, in your community. Groundwire is a listener-supported project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Support community radio news. Support Groundwire by donating now at ncra.ca.
David Ritchie graduated from high school as an Ontario Scholar. Some doubted it would ever be possible since David was born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. While many Canadians are familiar with the severe physical handicaps that are a result of alcohol use in pregnancy, children with a milder form of the disorder, known as fetal alcohol effects, are often overlooked, turned away from potential resources, or stigmatized. This month, VoicePrint collaborated with reporter Cam Wells from CJAM Radio to talk with families and advocates, like David's father, Bruce Ritchie, who are proving that with the right attitudes and support services, children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder will succeed.
My son, David, diagnosed shortly after birth, graduated from high school as an Ontario Scholar. That's a minimum requirement of 6 university preparatory courses with over 80% average in each. When he was first diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome shortly after birth, the future looked bleak and incredibly challenging. We were all shocked by the awards, including David, and absolutely delighted. He's now studying through Athabasca University in Edmonton, Alberta, online, living at home in Brightsgrove, Ontario.
Bruce Ritchie's journey with his son David, who has FASD, is inspirational. Ritchie's experience led him to become a moderator with Fetal Alcohol Disorder Society and spearhead the FAS Link initiative.
Our children have disabilities, but their biggest handicaps are the battles we have to fight to get the services to which they are entitled. David had microcephaly, sharp papilleal fissures, frequent microseizures, night terrors, failure to thrive. He had sensory integration issues with hypersensitivity to food taste and texture, as well as hypersensitivity to small pains such as slivers and small cuts, and dangerously high tolerance for major pain. He has extremely acute hearing. His MP3 player is at a volume of 1 out of 10. He cannot tolerate a noisy environment or machinery. At age 2, he was 6 months delayed in almost every category.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can lead to a number of disabilities. Kathy Mitchell is a representative of the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, located in Washington, D.C. She believes it's an underdiagnosed disability.
Most people never get the diagnosis. In most cases, it's almost a diagnosis that's made backwards. So, you know, mom and dad have a child, and mom drank, you know, somewhat, and maybe some moderate alcohol use. And then what happens when the child hits school age? All of a sudden, they're starting to get reports that their child has some attention problems, having some social problems, you know, needing extra help in math, needing extra support. And so, you know, usually the symptoms get addressed, but the cause, it's very rare.
We know that FASD is over 10%. It's about 12% of the population. Government tries to pretend that it's 1%, and that's based on studies that go back 25 to 30 years, and 37% of our children are exposed to binge drinking of 5 or more drinks per occasion. You know, more than 20% of our kids are receiving special ed. Half of those kids, actually more than half of those kids, are receiving special ed for conditions or types known to be caused by exposure to alcohol prenatally. It's numbers that government has chosen not to use.
The behavioral disorders associated with FASD often appear first in educational institutions. Yet because so little information is given to teachers and educators, parents like Ritchie are frustrated by the lack of support and resources.
The rewarding part is watching him grow, doing things that our kids do learn, can learn, but they learn quite differently.
For Groundwire, this is Cam Wells reporting in Windsor.
Thanks to Cam Wells from Windsor's CJAM Radio and VoicePrint for that collaborative report.
And that wraps up this edition of Groundwire. From CJSR in Edmonton, I'm David Karchin.
And I'm Zoe Lusky.
Thanks to headline producers Om Salma, Annabelle Koo, David Parker, Jackie Tuinstra Harrison, Gianna Lauren, Gretchen King, Joel Bard, and Frieda Worden. We thank our contributors from VoicePrint, CKUT, CHRY, CKDU, and CJAM. Music for this edition was provided by Edmonton band The City Streets. For their support, Groundwire thanks the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Visit cupe.ca. Groundwire also thanks the Public Servants Alliance of Canada. Think Public. Visit psac.ca. All episodes of Groundwire are available on groundwire.ncra.ca.